The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
We start with some breaking news out of Austria. Chancellor Alexander Schallenberg has announced a full nationwide lockdown starting Monday, and it will become the first European country to make COVID-19 vaccines mandatory starting February.
Austria's nationwide COVID shutdown is sending jitters across global markets. Cases have been spiking in other European countries like Germany.
A new milestone for the NASDAQ. The index topped the 16,000 mark for the first time Friday as declining bond yields pumped up tech stocks. But the Dow fell for the fourth time this week. Fears of new lockdowns in Europe to curb a resurgence of COVID-19 cases drove down banking, energy, and airline stocks, pushing the S&P 500 into the red as well.
The Build Back Better bill is passed.
Cheers rang out from Democrats in the House after passing President Biden's signature social spending bill.
It's a really cause for celebration for us now. It's historic. It's transformative. It's bigger than anything we've ever done.
We know exactly what the oil companies pay attention to, what is their number one priority, profits. If this were just ordinary inflation, we might see prices go up. But prices at the pump have gone up. Why? Price gouging. I think it's just another opportunity to make profits, and we need to call them out on that.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
It was another mixed week for stocks as markets pulled back on Friday over economic weakness caused by pandemic lockdowns in Europe. Well, despite these concerns, the NASDAQ hit another all-time record on Friday. Meanwhile, in Washington, a massive new social spending bill was passed in the House along party lines that could propel inflation much higher. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Up on deck at the top of the hour, Tom McClellan joins me. Tom believes the stock market is in the middle of a topping process. He sees gold prices heading higher, and he says it's time to start raising some cash and taking profits. Mark Chandler will follow and talk about higher interest rates is the main reason we're seeing strength in the dollar, as negative rates around the globe help support our currency. Mark is also cautious on stocks. And picking up on a theme, the times they are changing, how to thrive and survive with inflation. Chris Sheridan and I will talk about what to make of higher inflation rates. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Starting off with the news that hit markets Friday, Austria will begin a lockdown on Monday for 10 days, with reports that Germany will soon follow due to a rise in COVID-19 cases. Here in the States, Dr. Fauci warned that it may be difficult to sidestep a winter double whammy, as he called it, due to current vaccine immunity waning combined with the highly transmissible Delta variant. He said the third booster will help. As such, investors are taking a page right out of the previous COVID playbooks with a narrowing of leadership in stocks this week. While the mega cap and tech stocks hit new all-time highs exhibited in the NASDAQ Composite Friday, cyclical stocks were hit, with energy down approximately 5%, financials down 2.8%, materials down 1.8%, and industrials down 1% for the week. Deja vu all over again as interest rates fell in anticipation of weaker economic numbers in our future. There was some important news on Friday on this front, with the FDA extending the emergency use authorization of Pfizer and Moderna's COVID-19 booster shots for adults older than 18. Now, normally, news like this would help lift cyclical stocks in the past, but not so on Friday. Let's talk about a few of the highlights this week in economics, as the numbers were good as we started to get some November survey data, kicking off with the Empire State Manufacturing Survey, which jumped to 30.9 from 19.8 in October. Also this week was the Philadelphia Fed Index for November, which increased quite a bit to 39 from 23.8 in October. Tuesday retail sales slammed it, were strong in October, up 1.7%, and it was the same growth without auto sales, showing strong activity across most retail categories. Industrial production was up 1.6% in October, showing a lot of latent growth potential when supply chain issues subside. On the inflation front, we got news that import and export prices continue to rise. Import prices were up 10.7% versus a year ago, and exports were up 18% versus a year ago. Finally, the conference board's leading economic indicators were up 0.9% for October, finishing again a strong week showing in the economic reports. The Treasury yield steepened because of those strong results early in the week, but again because of COVID fears reversed towards the end of the week. On the earnings front, it was a week for retailers, coming off of those retail sales numbers. And I want to highlight two companies in particular. Despite Walmart's better-than-expected earnings results, the company fell on earnings Tuesday because of its plans to eat some of the higher costs it's seeing to keep its prices low and competitive. Target made similar comments when it reported Wednesday, saying it will absorb some inflationary pressure to keep prices down. Target said it's facing product cost increases from some vendors, and their operating margin dropped to 7.8% from 8.5% a year ago as a result, in addition to higher pay and headcount at its distribution centers. The disappointment hit both stocks pretty hard after seeing really strong results in those retail sales numbers on Tuesday. It wasn't all bad for all retailers. There was Home Depot and TJX, which beat and saw their stocks move higher post-earnings. Revenues were up 9.8% from a year ago for Home Depot as consumers continue to focus on upgrading their existing homes. Transactions over $1,000 were up 18%, which shows that consumers are focusing on larger house projects. Home Depot closed up 5.7% the day of its earnings release. For TJX, the company beat earnings by 3 cents and posted revenue growth of 23.9% year over year, and open-only comp store sales were up 14% over a 4% increase for the same period a year ago. Due to COVID, the company continued to refrain from forward guidance, and the stock was up 5.8% on the news. Getting into the weeds here a little, FactSet's John Butters wrote a nice piece you can find on the company's website about how supply chain was cited in earnings reports in 342 companies from companies that issued earnings in the S&P 500 from September 15th through November 19th. The five-year average, he said, is right around 178, so a huge increase here. And this ties into what both Target and Walmart were saying about trying to absorb costs to keep prices low and competitive, basically eating away at their margins. And because of this, the estimates for the fourth quarter profit margin expectations are dropping for the S&P 500, down to 11.8% estimated now. And that's down from the third quarter's 12.9% reported. And the near-term peak that we've seen this year in the second quarter at 13.1%. That's not completely worrisome because that's where margins have been for the past 3 years, but it is important to note as supply chain issues don't have an end in sight. And the recent storm-related blocks in British Columbia's roads and rails aren't helping, and they're pushing lumber prices higher yet again, up to $800 per 1,000 board feet, which is a spike of $250 this week, after hitting a low of $450 in August. Lastly, the House passed a $1.85 trillion Build Back Better Act on Friday, which the CBO estimates will add $160 billion to the budget deficit over 10 years. There's some articles out there that suggest the bill will need to be amended just to get through the Senate as well. That's it for this week's wrap-up report. Coming up next, let's take a look at this week's technician, Tom McClellan.
The position I take is that actually it's profits that drive the economy. It's profits that create prosperity. And the very simple observation I've made over the years is that it's profitable companies that do all the hiring. So the name of the game from a policy perspective should be to do no harm when it comes to companies that are profitable, allowing them to be profitable so that they can expand and create jobs and capital spending.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. FinancialSense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, a little bit of a struggle in the markets. Some of the major averages are having some difficulties. What does all this mean? Well, joining me on the program is Tom McCullen. Tom, last time we had you on the show, you were talking about the market was close to hitting a peak. Let's pick it up from there. And what do you see right now? Have we hit the peak or is that in the future?
We are hitting it right now, but not everything is hitting it at the same time. Small caps have already peeled off and started underperforming. The NASDAQ 100 and S&P 500 are still making slightly higher highs. The Dow's already made its high. So we're standing around the area of the top. And if our models that told us to expect this top are correct, the next 5 months are going to be pretty ugly. And I say 5 months because that's as far out as that model is able to look. It doesn't see further than that. But we also know from the, I think I shared in past appearances, a 10-year leading indication from crude oil prices says we're in for a long sideways slog for the next 3 years and then an ugly period in 2024. We can't trade 2024 today, but we can understand that we are shifting from a nice buy and hold strong uptrend market to one where market timing is going to be much more important.
So when you say more turbulence, is this going to be just a lot more volatility that we're going to see in the market?
I want to be very precise in the terms I use. And when you talk about volatility coming from a chemistry standpoint, a volatile chemical is just one that is more likely to react easily. So, you know, if you drop a lit match on a puddle of motor oil, yeah, it'll burn, but it won't explode. If you drop a lit match on gasoline, you'll singe your eyebrows off. So those are differences in chemical volatility. The volatility in the market, that term gets thrown around anytime the market does something that somebody doesn't like. They say, oh, it's volatility. Well, really what we should be talking about is the predisposition of the market to react more violently to any inputs. We're not seeing that right now. We're still seeing fairly quiet action. We're seeing it not linear uptrend, but we're seeing fairly quiet action. I don't necessarily think we have to have the chemistry version of volatility starting, but we are transitioning to a period where the market is just running out of gas and is going to have to go sideways for a while. And the Fed tapering is going to contribute to that and amplify that effect, an effect that was already going to happen anyway. The Fed doing what it's going to do at the wrong time, they're being what we call pro-cyclical as opposed to counter-cyclical. In other words, they're making the amplitudes of things worse.
And that seems to be their pattern. Just as inflation gets out of control, they should have done the tightening sooner, at least in my opinion, back when it first started to surface. But the theory was this is all transitory. Do you see it as transitory?
Yes, but they have expensive degrees in economics, and so they know better.
Well, you can always count on them. We have a saying here, they'll raise until they break something, or they'll taper until they break something. So, Tom, I want to talk about some charts, and we're going to put these up on our website for our listeners. The first chart you have is a Dow Jones Industrial Average log scale summation index. Explain what this chart is telling us.
All right. It does take some explanation. The summation index is one of the two indicators that my parents had created back in 1969 when they first started doing their own research into understanding why the stock market does what it does. They're more famous as the McClellan oscillator, but the summation index is a derivative of the oscillator. The summation index changes every day by the value of the oscillator. And in this case, I'm showing the ratio adjusted summation index. And what that means is that I'm adjusting it for the changing numbers of issues that are traded on the New York Stock Exchange. As you know, that varies over time with IPOs and mergers and things. And so this indicator factors that out. What we have found is that the plus 500 level on the ratio adjusted summation index, or the RASI, that plus 500 level is really, really important. You can have a dip below it, an ordinary garden variety correction. But if you fail to climb back above the plus 500 level, that's a sign of real trouble. The ratio adjusted summation index got up most recently up to plus 517. So basically right at the 500 line, and it has turned down and it has moved down even more today, Thursday, the 18th of November, when we're talking. And so what we call that is a plus 500 failure. In other words, the rocket took off, but it didn't achieve escape velocity, and so it's going to fall back in the ocean. When you see a higher high and the summation index, the ratio-adjusted summation index cannot get up above plus 500, that is a confirming sign of what our predictive models have said, is that there is just not the oomph to keep this uptrend going, and we are likely to see some corrective behavior with the price moving against the prevailing trend, which has been up for now, and I think it's really going to be the start of a bigger sideways to downward trend over the next several years.
And that brings me to the question, when you talk about a market peak, would you consider this a short-term peak or a long-term peak?
Well, we got to define our terms again. I like to use the definitions that Charles Dow used more than 100 years ago. We talked about a short-term trader as somebody who's looking to make a trade every few days. Intermediate-term trader is somebody who wants to trade every few weeks. And a long-term trader is somebody wanting to trade every few months. There are people who have a longer term perspective than that even. They're buy and never sell. So we're not even talking about those people. But yeah, we're talking about a top that is going to be a lasting and significant one, and it's going to lead to some other than upward behavior by the major averages over the next 2 to 3 years, and then some real ugliness in 2024.
Wow.
Sorry to be the messenger, but don't shoot me for that.
On this show, you call them the way you see them. So let's go to your next chart. It's decennial pattern of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It looks up. It's been trending up. We've had a pullback. What is this saying?
So just to understand what the decennial pattern is, it's like the annual seasonal pattern or the four-year presidential cycle pattern. You take the data and you chop it up into chunks of time and you average them together. In this case, we're averaging together 10-year periods of time to show what the average performance of the stock market is. And not surprisingly, the stock market tends to go up on average. If you average all these decades together, you see that the typical pattern is an uptrend. That doesn't mean we don't ever have bear markets. It's just that on average, they tend to occur at different times and they get smoothed out. But what's interesting about the decennial pattern is that the first about 4 years of a new decade, like the 2020s, typically is flat on average. Now, we've been doing better than flat, thanks to all the QE that Fed has been throwing at us in response to the COVID crash. But we may be pulling forward the gains that are due to arrive later in the decade. We may have overbitten of what we're supposed to do right now. And so the market is arguably deserving to head back in a reversion to the mean to give back some of those gains that have been pulled forward and get back to the more sideways period for the first years of the decade. Years ending in five tend to be wonderful years for the stock market, mostly because every other year ending in five is the third year of a presidential term. But the other ones are also generally up. And the latter part of the decade, for reasons unknown, but it's been going on for 100 years, so the latter part of the decade is a much stronger period for the stock market than the first 2 years that we're in right now.
In this next chart, you've got cooler, warmer, you've got commodity prices. There's a lot of stuff on here, so take your time and explain this one for our listeners.
Yeah, this is kind of fun, and this came about because I wanted to find out for myself more about this whole global warming phenomenon and climate change. And so I don't want to just believe what somebody tells me. I say, show me the data and let me understand it better. So I started looking at things and looking at actual climate data. And I found a few interesting insights that have been helpful for understanding the stock market. What we're showing here in red is a global average temperature series. And it's shown on an inverted scale. For reasons I'll get to in a minute, but the HADCRUT number four, that's the Hadley Climate Research Unit temperature series number four. They had three previous ones. And it's just a way of averaging together over 4,000 weather stations all around the globe to get one number for what is the global average temperature. What's interesting about the global average temperature is that if you invert it like I've done and shift it forward by 3 years, and it gives you a pretty good leading indication for what the inflation rate's going to do. And the black line is the 12-month rate of change for the consumer price index. The CPI-U means for urban consumers. That's the main one that most of the news headlines talk about. And it's not a surprise to your listeners that inflation has been spiking up a lot recently, partly because inflation dipped during the COVID crash when nobody was buying anything or spending anything. And now they're all wanting to go and buy and spend. And we can't ship in container ships full of goodies from China fast enough to satisfy everybody. So prices are responding. But this price response that we're seeing now in the CPI inflation numbers is also something that this global temperature series told us to expect right at this time. We've been in a cooling period since the 2016 El Nino peak in temperatures, which shows up as a low reading on a chart because of the inverted scale. So the cooling period that we had after the El Nino peak told us to expect an inflationary period 3 years later. And now we're at the 3 year anniversary of the dip in temperatures, the coolest part of that cool off from the El Nino peak. And so that's telling us to expect a peak in the inflation rate right now. So you brought up the question of whether inflation was going to be transitory. That's the word of the year this year about transitory. My understanding is that it's transitory, that we're going to see inflation at a 5 to 6% rate. And it's going to go back to something less than that. But inflation greater than the numbers that we would like to see is going to be with us for a while as the planet cools and as that affects agriculture and prices of things generally. And so the cool thing about this chart is that, yes, we can know that a disinflationary or a not as high inflationary period is in store lasting into 2023. And then we get some resurgence in inflation beginning at that point in 2023. And how much the earth cools or warms after right now will tell us more about what's in store for inflation on the longer term. This only looks out 3 years because that's the amount of lag time between temperature changes and inflation rate. And it doesn't get it perfect all the time. The global average temperature series didn't tell us about the severity of the commodity index bubble back in 2008 that pushed up oil prices to $145 a barrel. And it also didn't tell us that the Fed inducing the crash and the financial crisis 2008 would collapse oil prices all the way down to $31, which got magnified in the CPI response. But those dance steps were right on schedule with what the temperature series had said to expect. It's just that the dance steps were a lot louder. The COVID crash was also not on the schedule, according to the global average temperatures. And things like the COVID crash or lumber tariffs or things like that can put a thumb on the scale a little bit for what the inflation rate's going to do. But generally speaking, this is going to tell you what the trend is supposed to be. And the trend going forward for the next 3 years into 2023, the good news is that we're going to see declining inflation rates. But that doesn't mean it's going to get back down to zero. In fact, I don't think it will.
Well, speaking of inflation, I would have never thought we would see a CPI of 6.2%. and a 10-year treasury note at 1.6. So bond investors, not even counting taxes, are losing money due to inflation.
Yeah, Greenspan and others talked about irrational exuberance back in the 90s. I don't know what you call that. It's irrational something, but I'm not sure exuberance is the right word. But that's the strange situation we're in, and it doesn't really make sense to want to be long treasuries.
All right. Well, let's go to another inflationary asset. You've got a chart of spot gold here. It looks like it's breaking out. Explain this one.
Sure enough, it had a big triangle structure and a breakout. And so you can measure the height of the triangle at about the 04-05-21 grid line and apply that height to the breakout point, and that gets you an upside objective up around the prior highs. But more interestingly than the breakout is that the investors who buy in and sell the gold bullion ETFs, GLD and IAU, they're not responding to the breakout yet. That's what the red line shows. It's the total assets measured in gold bullion held by those two ETFs, GLD and IAU. Those are the two largest of the gold bullion ETFs. And generally speaking, when gold prices go up, more people want to own them. When gold prices go down, people want to sell out of them. It's normal, natural, the way to expect humans to behave. But when it gets interesting is when they don't do what they're supposed to do based on gold prices. When you see the gold price already has peaked and they're still buying, that tells you that they're really committed to their bullish action. What we're seeing right now is the gold prices are actually going up, and they're still selling. They are not yet recognizing that we have a breakout in gold prices. They're not believing in it. So that remains on their agenda to start believing in it and to start participating in the uptrend. And when they do, when they finally come around to believing in it and start buying, that they'll bring buying pressure with them that'll help push up the prices even more. At the point when they really start believing in it and really start piling in rapidly, then you'll know that the top is near. But we're nowhere near that point. They're not even yet believing in the uptrend. That tells me gold has further to go.
Well, you know, given the kind of sideways action that we've seen in gold throughout most of the year, maybe that's why they're not reacting. But if they do react, and all that money starts coming in, because the gold market is such a small market compared to any other asset class, could that push gold into new record highs?
Well, you know, you're asking the how far question. What I usually try to do is get the direction right and let the magnitude take care of itself. If I said it was going up to 2,000, or if I said it was going up to 2,100 from here, you'd still want to be a buyer either way. And so really projecting how far it's going to go isn't much useful to you. You want to just get the direction right. So I wouldn't put it past gold to make it up to a new all-time high. That's quite a possibility, especially with all the money that's sloshing around. We're not getting increasing amounts of gold sloshing around, but we do. And the price of gold is the amount of dollars per stuff. Well, if the stuff on the planet stays the same, but the amount of dollars goes up, then the dollars per stuff ratio will generally tend to go up.
So given what you're thinking of, we're in this area where the markets are peaking, what would you be doing as an investor?
Time to figure out what you want to start selling out of your stock market holdings, what you want to still hold on to. And for example, I think that oil prices have further to go up, so you may not want to get out of your energy names if they're going to be sensitive to oil prices going up. The hard question, though, is if the rest of the stock market starts going down, can rising oil prices that Tom McClellan is expecting still keep lifting up the drillers and the exploration companies in spite of that downward trend? And that's a harder question. I wouldn't want to be owning any long bonds right now. Cash looks pretty good. Gold looks pretty good. But it's time to... If you haven't learned how to be a market timer before, now's a great time to get a class on that. In an uptrend, you want to buy and hold and stay on. In a sideways to downward market, you want to sell high, buy low repeatedly, and know how to do that and switch sets of indicators that you look at to help you know how to do that. It's going to be a painful process for a lot of people to have to learn that. And some people are never going to learn it. They're going to still be committed to 30 years from now to buy and hold no matter what, because that's the way that they were raised. And you just can't change some people.
Hmm. So given that, Tom, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them about your website and what they're going to find there.
Well, we've been writing the McClellan Market Report since 1995. We're still charging just $195 a year for it. So we're single-handedly trying to hold the line against inflation. You can find out about that at our website, the mcoscillator.com. That's a contraction of the McClellan Oscillator that my parents created. We also have a daily edition that comes out every day the market trades. You can see samples of both of those and learn about subscribing at our website, mcoscillator.com. You can also sign up for our free weekly Chart and Focus article series. This week's article looked at some of the reasoning behind why stock market seasonality works the way that it does. Why do we peak in May and bottom in October? Well, there's some linkages to some human psychological events that we took a look at in that article this week. And you can sign up for free. There's no strings attached for the Chart and Focus. We won't spam you. We won't do marketing to you. We won't sell your name or sell our list to anybody. We just want to get more people acquainted with the indicators that we use.
All right. Well, listen, Tom, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Until we talk again, you have a pleasant holiday.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
This week, the dollar starts to break out. Will that trend continue? What does this mean for commodities and also for corporate profits? Joining us on the program is Mark Chandler. He's Managing Director and Chief Market Strategist for Bannockburn Global Forex. Mark, let's begin with the dollar. On the day you and I are speaking, which is a Tuesday, the dollar is breaking out. What is causing this to break out? Is it interest rates here versus elsewhere?
Sure. Yeah, Jim. It's what a move we're having, too. You know, the euro continues to break down and make new lows for the year. The driver, I think, really, in some ways, is really here in the U.S. It's not really so much just a weak euro. What's happened, I think, is that since we had that CPI shocker That was a 6.2% year-over-year CPI. That sort of was a big wake-up call to a lot of people in the market. And what I think the takeaway is that the Federal Reserve is going to most likely have to accelerate its tapering. Here's why. The Federal Reserve says, and this is in the FOMC statement and Powell's comments afterwards, one is the Federal Reserve wants to be prepared for a full range of possible outcomes, given the high degree of uncertainty. Right now, it is not prepared to be able to hike rates, say, in the first half of next year. And the reason it's not prepared to is because it's tapering. It's tapering, meaning it's slowing down its bond buying. It's not going to get finished with its bond buying at the current pace until June. This really ties the Fed's hands. And so the market is pricing in the odds of a rate hike in Q2 next year. And as the market's doing this, the dollar is going higher. And it's pretty clear why. The other two major central banks, the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan, are going to be laggards in this monetary cycle. And so the dollar is really is gaining ground against those two in particular.
Mark, what about the issue? We just passed, what is it, a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill. There was a $1.9 trillion stimulus passed earlier in the year. And then they're talking about another $2 trillion of social spending. So at the time, the deficits are going to get bigger and our debt is going to get larger and the Fed is going to be cutting back on purchases. What does that mean for interest rates?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question because, you know, as we sit here today, you know, our 10-year bond yield is hovering around 160. Incredible. We're talking about 6% inflation, 6.2% CPI, and the bond yield less than 1.6%. So why is the bond yield still so low? And I think that part of it is that the market does not believe that in this monetary cycle, the Federal Reserve will be able to raise interest rates, say, much above 2%. And so it's not simply the deficit. It seems like the appetite for buying U.S. treasuries remains strong. And part of the reason it remains strong is that there's something on the magnitude of $12.5 trillion of negative yielding bonds in Europe and Japan. And so as low as U.S. yields may be, in nominal terms and also real terms, the positive yield is really an attraction. Plus, this year, especially, you know, ironically, since January 6th, the U.S. dollar has been generally appreciating. So not only do you get a higher yield for being in the U.S. than you do in Europe or Japan, but you also get the dollar at your back. And so I think that what's going to happen is really almost the opposite, Jim, and that is that going forward, the U.S. deficit is likely to get smaller. The debt, to your point, is going to continue to rise, but the deficit is likely to get smaller. That's what concerns me, not so much in the next couple of quarters. There's enough fiscal stimulus, enough monetary stimulus still in the pipeline, still pent-up consumer demand. But by the time we get into the second half of next year, we're going to be looking at tighter Fed policy, tighter fiscal policy, and that pent-up demand being exhausted. And I think that we're going to be looking at 2% growth at best.
So, Mark, as the dollar rises, how is this going to impact corporate earnings? Because a lot of the companies in the S&P and especially the Dow companies are international companies. So if the dollar is going up against the euro, the yen, or other Asian currencies or Latin America, those profits or sales get translated into lower numbers. So what might this mean for the markets in the next year?
Yeah, I think you're right, Jim. You know, this is going to be the when corporate America reports earnings in for Q4, the stronger dollar will act as a headwind. But remember, there's plenty of hedging tools available. It's not like corporate treasurers have to fly in the blind. There's hedging tools and favorable accounting treatment for hedging. So in some ways, we're talking about insurance that corporates can take on. But I think you're right that the stronger dollar is going to be a headwind to corporate earnings. But so far, they've shown reasonably strong pricing power. And despite rising input prices, rising labor costs, corporate America still had a solid Q3 when the dollar's rally was already well underway.
So as the Fed continues with taper, they're beginning with $15 billion, and that goes up every month, I think. What do you think that's going to mean for the market? Because the Fed is now pulling liquidity away from the market instead of injecting it. What might that mean?
Yeah, so you know, what we're talking about is since March of last year or so through earlier this month, the Federal Reserve was buying $120 billion of bonds. That's mostly $80 billion of treasuries, $40 billion of agencies a month. And now it has slowed down. So this month it took $15 billion off. So that means that they're buying $105 billion. They're still injecting money, but at a slower pace. And what's interesting about the slower pace is exactly at the same time the Fed is buying less bonds, the federal government is issuing fewer bonds. So we've seen a reduction in the quarterly refunding, for example, and reducing the size of other auctions this quarter. It's not exactly one for one, but it's important to recognize that as the Fed slows down its buying, the government is slowing down its issuance. It's not coordinated in any way. It wasn't meant to be, but it's a happy coincidence. And so, of course, I think I share your sentiment that we're still dealing with very high asset valuations. Bonds at 160 for the 10-year, when we're talking about 6% inflation, the stock market, which, you know, we get a wobble every so often, like we did with the CPI number or back in, was it September, when the Evergrande, the Chinese company, was going to be the biggest thing since Lehman. We wobble and we come back. And partly the reason I think that the stock market continues to come back is that people see very little alternative how to deploy their savings. What do you do with your 401k or your IRA? Do you stay in the stock market or do you buy bonds? And I think that the stock market has rewarded people for sticking with it, and might not always do that, of course. But so far, it's still paying off. And I think that's what's keeping people involved.
Now, what about, you know, when you take a look at all of this liquidity, you mentioned valuations. You and I were talking about before we went on the air, this new EV company that went public. I think that's worth more than the entire auto industry, and yet they have no sales.
Yeah, it's remarkable. You know, I'm old enough to remember like various dot-com blow-ups. And I think we're going to see that in other sectors. And of course, it's a very exciting time for the electric vehicles. And I think it's like a bit of a wild west where people are trying to latch on to different parts of that sector. And you see this with other companies as well. And so it's hard to know, but generally I can't help but think that ultimately what's happened in this crisis is rather than the destruction of wealth, the governments did, especially, you know, I want to say that they did the democratic thing. They preserved income levels. They preserved wealth levels. And the price to be paid for that is that it is frothy, that there still is a surplus of savings. And I think that's why they're still talking about those $12.5 trillion of negative yielding bonds, low U.S. interest rates, high valuations, because there's so much money circulating. And to your point about liquidity, and I just don't know how that story is going to end. But it seems to me that these companies that have no sales and huge market cap, or the explosion in the crypto space. I mean, today's a down day after the infrastructure bill passed, it was signed, that has a sort of trying to tighten up the tax rules about crypto trading. But in general, it just seems to me that these kinds of newfangled assets, if you will, are, I compare it to what trees do to carbon. You know, trees are a great carbon suck. And I think these prices of assets like crypto, they mentioned this EV company. I think that this is just another, like, it's a saving. It's savings looking for an outlet.
So when you take a look at some of these valuations that we have right now, and we're talking about the Fed cutting back on liquidity, we talked about some headwinds for corporate profits. You know, Mark, are they really in a position, given the level of debt and future levels of debt, where they can tighten? And I'm not talking just about government debt. I'm talking corporate debt. Think of all the, what, half of the investment grade companies are triple B, just one notch above junk. And then you talk about consumer debt. Can our system withstand higher interest rates like what the Fed did in the 00 decade when they raised the Fed funds rate to 5%.
Yeah, I think, Jim, I think this is what's really one of the key driving things. Economists call it R-star. That's sort of the real short-term interest rate if the economy was at capacity. What's that equilibrium interest rate? And that rate continues to fall. And as that rate falls, that means discounting future earnings is more attractive. It's the discount factor of low interest rates is just this huge multiplier that ripples through the capital markets. And so that's what I think that the driving force is. The market now recognizes that that COVID, the shutting down of the world economy, did not really destroy capital, which would have pushed our star higher, but had quite the opposite effect. And our star is probably lower now than it was 2 years ago. And so that has serious implications for how far, how much leverage and how like this financial system can still be juggling these spinning plates.
Well, the thing that really surprises me about this whole market, if we were going back, Mark, 20 years ago, or maybe even 30, and you would have told me the inflation rate is 6.2%, and we'd be dealing with 1.6% 10-year treasury yields, or that gold would be virtually almost flat going nowhere, I would have said you're crazy.
Yeah, it's an unusual outcome. I don't think anybody could have predicted this with 6% inflation and such low yields, not only at the long end, but, you know, we're still talking at the short end of the curve. The 2-year yield is just above 50 basis points. When we're talking about 6% inflation. So it tells you about where real interest rates are. And even with these very low, that is negative real interest rates, the economy, I'm still warning, is going to be suffering. That this the talk now is whether inflation is temporary or not. And I think, like, of course it's going to be temporary because growth itself is going to be temporary. The fiscal stimulus is going to end. The monetary stimulus is going to come to an end. Pent-up demand will be exhausted. And one other thing that I point out would be that in the last three business downturns in the U.S., they were preceded by a doubling of the price of oil. Oil prices have doubled in the past year. I'm not talking about that negative of April of 2020, but just since the vaccine was announced, talking about a doubling of the price of oil. I think these headwinds are going to slow the economy down and will help deal with the inflation problem.
So the 6% year-over-year inflation that we're seeing now, some would say, Mark, that the inflation rates are probably a little bit higher if you get substitution and hedonics taken out of it. I mean, I don't care if you're looking at used cars, if you're looking at TV sets, you're looking at food, gasoline at the pump, insurance fees, everywhere you look, I'm seeing high single digit or if not double digit price increases.
Yep. I think this is the pain that we bear right now. I think the point would be that we shouldn't extrapolate it too far. That is, yes, prices have risen farther than economists had expected, but I think that we want to, you know, this was an unprecedented shock. The global economy shut down, trying to reopen. And as it reopens in a very uneven fashion, there's been a couple of things that don't seem so much related to supply shock. What's happening with oil prices, for example, is not simply the supply shock. The semiconductors, while it's easy to think of it as a supply shock, there's some other elements there. For example, the U.S. Basically blacklisted China's largest semiconductor producer and its largest consumer of semiconductor chips. This has also distorted the recovery. And so, you know, the Bank for International Settlements, you know, is the sort of the world's central bank for central bankers. Bank for International Settlements, their latest report estimates that if you were to take away the supply shocks, the U.S. CPI would be closer to 2.5%. And again, I think that the rise in oil price and gasoline prices, I know that it costs you more to heat your house, more to fill the car with gasoline. But this is really should be thought about from an economic point of view as really a tax on consumption, which means that the more it takes to heat the house or to fill the car with gasoline, the less money we have to spend on other discretionary things. And because of that, that's why it acts as a brake, as a deterrent on other types of consumption. So economists are mostly interested in the general price increase. And it does seem that we should be bracing ourselves for an acceleration of inflation in the next couple of months. But towards the end of Q1 is now where I would imagine that we're going to see, if it hasn't peaked then, it'll peak around then. And that's partly because of the base effect. And I'm thinking that some of the supply chain disruptions are slowly easing. You know, we saw the first increase in U.S. auto sales in October in 6 months. And partly it looks like it's coming from better access to semiconductor chips.
So given the nature of where we are right now, we've got a rising dollar. We talked about some potential headwinds here over the next 3 to 4 months. Mark, as an investor, what would you be doing?
I'm scared. I haven't really done anything. I mean, I've lightened up on, you know, there was a stretch there where the S&Ps were up 12 out of 15 sessions, and the NASDAQ might have been up a little bit more. I took advantage of that just to sell some of the index ETFs that I have to raise some cash, waiting for a reasonable pullback to go back in.
Well, I tell you, when I take a look at some of the blue chip stocks we own, where you have companies like, you know, a Coca-Cola selling at almost 28, 30 times earnings, I mean, it just, you know, it reminds me of what it was like during the internet bubble, where you saw PE ratios of 40, 50, and 60 on companies that were growing probably half that amount.
Yes, the valuation is stretching. That's why I think it's like the idea is, I think up until, I don't know, maybe this summer or so, I thought, well, the idea is to buy dips. But it's occurring to me that it's not good enough to buy dips. But you have to sell, you have to lighten up on the rallies to give you the wherewithal to be able to buy the dip, as well as emotionally to keep me grounded.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Well, listen, Mark, as we close, our listeners, if they wanted to follow you, how can they do so?
Sure, thanks, Jim. So I have a blog, and I'm fortunate that my employer lets me keep my commentary on the blog. It's called Mark to Market, Mark with a C, makes my mother happy. I'm also on Twitter, and so my Twitter handle is Mark Making Sense, and it's not just about an ego. It's really a takeoff of my first book called Making Sense of the Dollar.
All right. Well, listen, Mark, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Have a nice holiday, and we'll talk to you later.
Thanks, Jim. Good luck to everybody.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Jim, starting in April of last year, you began a new series titled The End of Money, explaining how the trillions of dollars now being spent into the economy and markets, which would lead to a large pickup in debt, all because of COVID, meant that there were basically three outcomes. One, we could pay down the large debt that we were accumulating. Two, the U.S. could default on its debt. Or three, it could inflate it away. And as you wrote early last year, quote, throughout history, governments from Egyptian pharaohs, Roman emperors, kings, prime ministers, and presidents have chosen the inflation way out. And then you also explained how the smart money was going to prepare for that outcome by moving into commodities. So here we are a year and a half later after you wrote about this, and we have clearly seen a big pickup in inflation, a big pickup in commodities. So it's played out as you had predicted. So let's start with what we're seeing now on the inflation front currently in terms of the official data and what's really happening that all of us are experiencing.
Well, if we take a look at the common measures of inflation, let's take CPI. It's the highest it's been in nearly 31 years, 6.2% year over year. But the problem is, Chris, the real inflation number is probably twice that. The government uses something called hedonics, and they use substitution. And what hedonics does is, let's take TV prices are up almost 10% year over year. Well, the government would argue, well, but the new TV is 4K instead of regular, or it's 8K. So we have to back out some of the price increase to reflect the increase in technology or the things that it does. Or let's say Ford raises prices 15% on cars and trucks. Then you might say, well, the truck gets better gas mileage. It's a nicer engine. So we're going to back that out. So the real inflation, and I don't need to remind anybody, just take a look at what you're paying at the pump, food, insurance premiums, utilities, all the way across the board, everything from services, all of that is much higher. And what is really key to understand here going forward, because you're hearing all kinds of nonsense coming out of the idiots in the media, is basically, oh, this is just temporary. And if we actually pass more spending bills, will bring the cost of inflation down, which is purely idiocy. So inflation is being driven directly now by government policy. So we're now in a period where we are going to get higher rates of inflation, as I just mentioned, the CPI highest in 31 years. And we're moving out of this long secular disinflationary environment that began in 1981 to the current period. Because of MMT, modern monetary theory, both parties, Republicans, Democrats, policymakers, bureaucrats, have all embraced this new philosophy that basically, if you have your own currency, you can print and spend as much money as you want, and it's not inflationary, which is garbage. And that's why we're seeing these higher levels. And have you noticed the shift in the conversation now? It's gone from, well, this is transitory to, well, maybe it's going to be transitory for a much longer period of time, which is saying we've got a higher inflation in the road ahead of us. And it's interesting, the recent poll just came out in the last day or so. Number one concern of Americans today is the economy and inflation, and the administration and the politicians are ignoring this and going forward with more things that are going to drive inflation even higher.
As we discussed in one of our prior programs, Jim, there's the five denials of inflation by the Fed and by the government. You know, the first denial is, it's transitory. Then the second stage is transitory is lasting a little bit longer than we thought. Then the third denial is, well, at this point, it is persistent. Fourth, the trade-offs of higher inflation are actually worth it. And then eventually the fifth and final stage is, well, we just need to implement price controls and targeted taxation measures.
Oh, absolutely. I saw, you know, some idiot in the media today said that, well, this inflation really is a good sign. That means people have money to spend, and that's a good thing. You know, it's just stuff like that. But anyway, we are heading for higher inflation. It may recede at a lower level temporarily if the Fed induces a recession, or if policy induces a recession, which it could very well do, because this bill that's working its way is one giant, massive tax increase. So, you know, that may have a dampener on the economy. I disagree with some of the economists that we've had here that, you know, taxes have no impact on the economy, which is BS.
And, you know, when it comes to the official CPI measure, as you mentioned, you know, highest inflation surge year-over-year terms at 6.2%, that is an average, right? So no average is going to capture everyone's experience. And even if you look at state by state, there's going to be pretty significant differences in that number as well. I mean, even if you just look at the official data, some states are more around 5%, where some other states are seeing as high as, you know, 7.5%. Right. And then you can talk about, well, let's drill down into someone who really is just spending all of their income on food and energy, or perhaps they're more exposed to these inflationary pressures through rent, for example. Let's say they're in a place where housing is very expensive and rent is going up pretty quickly. Well, then their inflation rate that they're experiencing, that may be 10%, 15%. Right. So there's big differences based on the person, the unique circumstances, even the state. So the 6.2%, we have to understand it's probably not going to apply to everyone. Everyone is going to be different. And like you pointed out, there's a lot of different hedonic adjustments that they make as well. But let's talk about how this relates to the next Fed rate cycle as you see it.
Well, if you take a look at our debt levels, they're massive. And with these spending programs, you have to understand Not only, you know, Trump drove the deficit up, he was running trillion-dollar deficits when he was president, but the COVID response in 2020 raised the deficit to over $3 trillion. Now you fast forward to this year, $1.9 trillion spending bill in January. They just passed a $1.2 trillion infrastructure spending bill, and the House just passed another $2 trillion, I call it Build Back Worse program. So that's another $2 trillion. So, Chris, the government's budget is $6 trillion, and we're adding another $5 trillion on top of this. And what makes this inflationary, let's go back to the definition of inflation, too much money chasing too few goods. So the government is pushing money into directly consumer pocketbook and into the economy at the same time the Fed is printing money. Now, they cut back, and this month they're cutting back by $15 billion, but Chris, it's still $105 billion. And that's why I think in this Fed rate raising cycle, debt levels now are accelerating at 2 to 3 times the rate of increase in economic growth. And the only way you're going to get out of this is debt monetization. So if you look what the Fed's trying to do, and here's a perfect example of this, they're going to try to control the yield curve, meaning interest rates on the longer end of the spectrum when it comes to the bond market, because they have to. If they don't, if this economy cannot handle higher interest rates at the corporate level, the individual level, and the government level. So they're going to suppress long-term interest rates. And the best example I can give you right now is inflation is running at 6.2%. On the day you and I are speaking, 10-year treasuries are at 1.6%. So, and that's before taxes. Remember, you pay taxes on the interest income you get for treasuries. You get to exempt it from state taxes. So it's actually much worse. So if you're in bonds right now, you're automatically losing 5 to 6% purchasing power each year. And as getting back to my Death of Money article, the only way that they're going to be able to manage these levels of debt is to inflate it away. So a lot of these policies are intentional because they know they need to inflate this debt away because we don't have the income to pay for it, to pay it down. And we certainly aren't going to default because we can just print as much money as we want. So this idea about, you know, we've got the debt ceiling debate coming up next month, and the media is going to get out there and scare the crap out of you by saying, you know, oh my God, we're going to default. We're not going to default. I mean, that's nonsense. It's just media stupidity. I mean, we can print as much money as we want to pay that. So anyway, the next Fed rate cycle, Chris, I don't think they're going to get all the way through taper. And good luck trying to raise interest rates in this environment and watch what you do to the economy, because the Fed has got to be very cautionary here. If they raise or taper too much, collapse the financial markets, which they could do because they're withdrawing liquidity and now raising interest rates. And that travels all throughout the economy, from mortgage loans to car loans to home equity loans, all those kind of things. They could actually shut this economy down. You add that to a massive, and I mean massive, tax increase, and those kind of things, along with inflation, could put us back into a recession in the short term.
Yeah, and as you also discussed in your article from early 2020, not only is it the massive amount of spending that would be inflationary, but also another part of it that you discuss is just the way in which the government responded with policy measures in light of COVID, right? By shutting down all these different businesses, millions of small businesses around the U.S., that is the main source of employment for Americans, and funneling all that into a small number of approved stores, right? Big box retailers and grocery stores, for example. That's highly inflationary.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the COVID response destroyed a large segment of the U.S. economy. The service sector, part of the manufacturing sector, was destroyed. Over a million businesses were destroyed. 58 million people at one point were put out of work. And then the other thing is they came in and created these non-incentives for not working. I mean, you could make more money on unemployment benefits, not only from your own state, but supplemental benefits that were coming from the federal government. They were actually, you remember, Chris, when they gave those big stimulus checks that they were writing to everybody. So they create this non-incentive, which makes it harder for a lot of these businesses to hire people. And if they do, I mean, I've seen, You know, when you have fast food chains giving incentives just to get people to work, you're also building this new social bill that's working its way through Congress now, is moving the U.S. towards a European socialism. A lot of entitlements are going to be created with this. And the real risk to this is that once these entitlements are created, that just expands the government's budget and obligation even further. Once an entitlement is created, they're not going to take it back. So that's some of the gimmickry that went into passing this bill. They're saying, well, we're going to put all these programs in place, but we're only going to fund them for a couple of years. That's balderdash. Once they're in place forever. And they go up every single year, and it becomes automatic spending. So the deficits are going to get bigger year by year. The other thing, too, is, and we've seen this in history, I can't think of the article I wrote. I showed the percentage of the U.S. economy that has gone to taxes. And it doesn't matter if tax rates were at 94% during the middle of World War II, 70% as they were all the way up to Ronald Reagan, or you raise them to 39.6 or you lower them. The government typically takes in anywhere between 19 and 20% of the economy in tax revenues. Because what happens when you raise taxes? You have people like ourselves who are financial advisors, you have tax attorneys and tax accountants that start taking measures to reduce taxes. Now, I did see in this bill, there's something called the backdoor Roth, which we use with a lot of our clients. It's a way for people that are contributing money to 401k programs to get beyond the limitations on income and also put in larger amounts. This bill would do away with backdoor Roths. So they're trying to cut that. The other issue, supply chain issues are going to persist because of regulations. Our California is a good example. They changed the trucking laws and environmental laws that a lot of truckers now are avoiding California for many reasons. Not just the regulations. You have to have a 2011 vehicle. By 2030, you're not going to be able to bring a diesel truck in this country or in this state. And then on top of that, you take a look at fuel cost. If you're a truck driver and independent truck drivers, your biggest cost of operating your business is fuel cost. You come across the border in the U.S., you know, you go from, like Arizona, you go from $3 to almost $5 when you get into California. So the only reason I say this, I have two brother-in-laws that are independent truck drivers. They no longer take loads into California. It's just too expensive and uneconomical. So you have supply issues with regulation, and then also an issue that we're all dealing with here, whether it's the ships offshore and our ports, is the supply chain. In the last three decades, we outsourced so much of our manufacturing from goods to drugs to China. So just take a look at shipping costs. The cost of a shipping container has gone up 4 or 5 fold. You know, that gets added into the cost of goods. Not only that, as fuel costs rise, it costs more to, you know, run a ship across the ocean, then put those goods onto a truck and then get them into the store. So this is rippling through the economy. And the new bill passed is in the process of implementing new entitlement spending. Chris, this is going to require massive new spending going forward that will be permanent. The other issue at risk here is Medicare. They're going to expand Medicare at a point where the Medicare trustees say they run out of money in 2026. And here we're going to make more people eligible for it. And then at the same time, we're going to expand it. I mean, this is just basically nobody with any economic sense is coming up. Then you add environmental restrictions that are going to drive energy. We are shutting down pipelines. We're shutting down drilling. We're shutting down mining. And then our only response is to ask OPEC basically produce more energy for it. It's hard to believe. 2 years ago, the U.S. was producing 13 million barrels a day of oil, the largest producer in the world, and now we're totally dependent on OPEC. I mean, it's just absolutely insane. And then if you want to talk about going to this green energy, what do we need for green energy? You need silver. If you're talking about solar panels, you need copper. If you want to talk about EVs and charging stations, you need lithium for batteries. You need rare earth minerals. And we're shutting down mines. We're shutting down and not allowing a mine to go into operation in Minnesota. We're doing the same in Arizona. We're doing the same in Alaska. So, Chris, and even our own state here in California, we're shutting down our last nuclear power plant that is going to deprive us of 10% of our energy needs. So a lot of this stuff just simply has no economic rationale behind it.
Along those lines, here are two clips that have now gone viral. The first is from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, and then the second is from the Secretary of Energy, Jennifer Granholm, about what is the administration's plan when it comes to high oil and gas prices.
There's some Republicans who have taken this moment where they've seen gas prices spike to criticize sort of the administration big picture, right? Canceling Keystone Pipeline, halting leases for new drilling leases on federal land, saying that sort of the administration's policies writ large have contributed to the rise in gas prices. What's your response now to that?
Our response is that the rise in gas prices over the long term makes an even stronger case for doubling down our investment on clean energy options. That's our view.
What is the Granholm plan to increase oil production in America?
Oh my God, that is hilarious. Would that I had the magic wand on this.
And of course, the unfortunate thing about both of those responses is, one, when it comes to Jen Psaki, she says that higher oil and gas prices doesn't mean, oh wait, maybe we need to rethink our strategy so we don't end up with the same problem Europe is in right now. No, instead, the response is this just means we need to push even harder into renewables and pulling away from fossil fuels, regardless of the economic impacts or of how much inflation this is causing. And then on the energy secretary's side, Jennifer Granholm, Tom Keene asks her, what's the plan to lower energy costs? And she just laughs. I mean, this is just mind-blowing stuff, Jim.
Yeah, it's amazing that they persist with doing this, but this gets back to how we're going to get out of this debt crisis, and that is to inflate it away. So there's intentional policy here, because look at it this way. Inflation is running at 6% and probably twice that. So if they can inflate away debt, it makes it more manageable.
All right, Jim. Well, as we usually do, let's boil all this big picture macro information on why we believe that inflation is going to be increasing or staying at a much higher than average level for the long term. And you've said up to a decade that you believe for the remainder of this decade, we should be getting used to higher than average inflation. In which case, what are some of the investment implications that come from this?
Well, the first one that comes to mind, for almost half a century, the financial industry has operated under the 60-40 rule. And that's 60% in equities, 40% in bonds. And it worked very well, Chris, for almost half a century. So if the stock market went into a bear market, the economy went into a recession, interest rates would go down, the value of your bonds would go up and offset some of the losses you had in the stock market. And I think if you go back to some of the severe corrections that we had, had you had bonds, you know, your losses were minimized because your bonds were appreciating. That's no longer working. And I'm just reading here from my Bloomberg screen. This is an aggregation of all bonds from AAA to BBB, maturities from 1 to 10 years plus, and different categories, treasuries, government bonds, corporate bonds. And let me just give you an idea here. Overall, bonds have lost about 2 to 3% this year. And that's in some of the biggest losses have occurred in treasuries, also in A-rated corporate bonds. You're seeing bigger losses all the way up to almost 4% on bonds that go beyond 10 years. And remember, the losses are actually higher. These losses assume the income you're getting from the bonds. So if you are spending the income you're getting from bonds and not reinvesting, your losses are probably in the neighborhood of about 5-6%. And that's all across the board. So, Chris, this isn't working anymore. It implies a different kind of a strategy. One thing that we've done over the last couple of years, now, this is a major change going forward, because in a disinflationary environment, which we've been for almost four decades now, the idea was you wanted to invest longer term because you had what was called reinvestment risk. So let's say you had a one-year treasury bill and you were getting, I don't know, this is going back a number of years, you were getting a couple percent. When that one-year treasury bill came due, you probably got a lower interest rate. So advisors were saying, hey, stretch out your maturity so you can lock in your yields on bonds and have predictable income. Well, now we're going to be reversing that because now we are in a rising interest rate environment. You can take a look at that. You can see it in 2-year treasury yields, 5-year treasury yields, even in 2-year treasury yields, which is something we follow very closely. So the thing now is we like individual bonds. We like them short term because when they come due, number one, you get your money back. Number two, you've locked in a rate of interest that's predictable. And number three, you're probably going to roll it over at a higher interest rate. So we are now in an inflationary environment, which puts a lot of these bond funds at risk. I mean, you just go down the road. I don't care from TLT, the ETFs. You know, bonds are at a loss this year compared to the market. And the new, the thing that you need, and this affects a large swath of the population, not only those that are retired who are depending on income to live on, but also pension funds that are going to have to meet these obligations for their retirees. And so you need a higher rate of return because otherwise these pension funds are not going to meet their objectives. And let me give you an example. The required distributions from IRA pension accounts were changed under Trump. We went from mandatory distributions at age 70 and a half. We went to age 72. Well, at age 72, you have to take out 3.91% of your IRA to avoid the 50% tax penalty. But here's a key. The following year at age 73, it rises to 4.05 and goes up every year for the remaining of your lifetime. So that alone, at age 73, you're already going to be forced to withdraw more than the 4% that planners have used for retirement planning. There's this thing called the 4% rule. If you withdraw only 4% of your assets, you can live your entire retirement years, not worry about, going broke. Well, you take a look at these mandatory distributions, you're already going to be taking out more than the 4% rule. So one of the things that you're going to have to survive here is, number one, if you were in the bond market, I would either, if you can, get individual bonds so you don't lose any money and you have predictable income, or if you have no other choice to be in a bond fund, you want to be in a short-term fund with a short duration so you don't get walloped as interest rates rise. So that's number one. Number two, we're moving to a hard asset environment. You can see this with art, collectibles, real estate. I mean, just look at real estate prices. I don't care if you're talking about apartments, if you're talking about single family homes, McMansions, apartment complexes, all of these are going up. Commodities are going to be rising. This is going to be a decade of commodity price inflation, everything from ags to base metals to oil. And then the other thing that we've seen that have taken place over the last couple of years, dividend yields are much higher on blue chip stocks than anything you can get in the treasury market or bond market. I don't care if you're looking at 10-year treasuries at 1.6 or 30-year bonds below 2%. I can get 3, 4, 5, and 6% dividend yields in the stock market with blue chip companies. I mean, in our income fund, which is 60% dividend stocks, I mean, our dividends have gone up 9% a year. So how many people out there are really getting a 9% pay increase? So you're going to have to rely more on blue chip dividend type stocks, because what are you going to do if your cost of living is going up at double digits every single year, from gas to food to utilities to water to insurance premiums? Everywhere you look at the things you buy are going up, and that's going to be persistent. And what we see this decade is a decade of turbulence, turmoil, and geopolitical conflict. So what we've drawn the conclusion is inflation and oil and a lot of these things may recede. The only thing that's going to bring oil prices down, because policy is not, policy is going to drive prices higher. They're talking about shutting down another pipeline that comes in from Canada that would cut off 2 million barrels a day. Also, it's more expensive to transport oil by rail or by truck than it is a pipeline, and it's much safer. So we may see a little bit of pullback of inflation in a recession, but the response that will come from the Fed and the government to any slowdown or market turbulence is going to be massive. And, you know, I don't know how to describe that word, because what we're doing right now is massive. I've never seen this kind of spending in my whole career in the investment business. I mean, we used to be worried, Chris. I can remember in 1991, when Bill Clinton got elected, we were running $450 to $500 billion a year deficits. We passed tax increases. We were concerned about $450 billion. Now we're running $3 trillion, $4 trillion deficits, and they're only going to get bigger as we go forward. So this is going to be a decade of inflation. It's a different investment strategy, just like the 00 decade was. And I want to point that out. This wasn't long ago. If you take a look at the 00 decade, the stock market represented by the S&P went nowhere for 13 years. Nowhere. And the only positive return you got in the stock market was your dividends. Oil went up. It went from $20, $10 a barrel in 98, went all the way up to 150 base metals. Gold went from 250, 300, all the way up to 2000. And you don't want to even know or begin to know where I think gold is going. You'd probably think I'm nuts. But in my opinion, it's heading towards 10,000, and silver is going to be explosive. So all these things are going to cost more money, and you better plan for it, because this is going to be a decade of turbulence and inflation going forward.
So again, given all the things that we discussed today, we've been consistently warning to get ready for higher inflation ever since early 2020, and explaining the need to both hedge and invest around this for the years to come. We may be close to a near-term peak in the absolute rate of inflation, but that said, we still believe this is a long-term investment theme. And if you'd like to know how we can help you and what steps to take, give us a call at 888-486-3939. Once again, that's 888-486-3939.
And coming up next week, it'll be Thanksgiving holiday. We want to wish all of you a happy Thanksgiving. We are going to be running a special edition of some very insightful interviews that Chris Sheridan did on FS Insider. They'll be played next week. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. We hope you have a pleasant holiday weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.